The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to novelist Bill Sheft, author of Shrink Thyself. You may also know him as a writer for The Late Show with David Letterman. This is his second appearance on our show. Stick around. No psychobabble will be harmed or mispronounced in the course of this conversation. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of monologue lovers who are so glad I'm not doing one today in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Charlie Traub wants to be sports writer John Feinstein. Bill Sheft wants to be Philip Roth or maybe Bruce J. Friedman. The difference? Traub is a fictional character. He has no chance. Sheft, on the other hand, I'll give a .463 shot at it. Why .463? That was famed Boston Red Sox right fielder Tony Conigliaro's career slugging percentage.
Wow.
What does Conigliaro have to do with it? If you don't know, you obviously haven't read Sheft's third novel, Shrink Thyself, have you? Sheft's new comic fiction about an aimless TV news talk producer, Charlie Traub, who wants to be a sports writer, is all about the unexamined journey, less so the destination. It follows the disintegration of our man Traub as everything that could go wrong in his life does. What does Traub learn about himself? Does one disaster after another change his life? Not necessarily. He's still the same unlovable loser, slipping away a little more every day of his miserable existence. That's not the case for Sheft, however, who's been a staff writer for David Letterman since 1991, is the author of three previous novels, and is married to comedian Adrian Tulsh. Now, this is Sheft's second time around on Mr. Media. The first time we talked about Everything Hurts. And you can still hear that anytime you like in the Mr. Media archives. Bill Sheft, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Thanks very much. It's good to be back. And we were talking before I went on, and I said that it was my fourth or fifth time on Skype, but it's only my second time doing an interview. The other three times were with a homeopath. So this is number two with the interviews.
Well, one of my policies is that homeopaths and osteopaths, they don't count. I'm sorry. They just don't count.
Fair enough.
All right. So good to know. And while we're acknowledging things, I'll acknowledge that I just realized that my math was wrong. I know you've done four books altogether, and I think I said it.
Five books altogether, four novels, and the collection, The Best of the Show, which is a collection of my Sports Illustrated columns.
All right. So I acknowledge that I screwed that up.
That's okay.
So, Bill, you've got this snazzy day job. What I want to know is why devote your free time to roto-rootering Charlie Traub's inner demons?
You know, as in the case with all my fiction writing, You know, I was one of those guys, I thought I did not have the gene in me to write a novel because I had spent my life, you know, as a comedian for stand-up comedian for 13 years, and I had spent, as I like, and then a sports writer before that, and I had spent my life, as I like to say, writing in installments, you know, writing newspaper articles and magazine articles and jokes and scripts and these bite-sized forms. I just didn't think I had it in me to write a novel. And when I wrote my first novel, and that's the one that didn't get published, as it shouldn't have, I loved the process because it was so different from all the other writing I did. So I write fiction for many reasons, but one of the most appealing reasons is how different it is from writing jokes or writing scripts or writing, you know, wise guy things. The process is so much slower. I liken it to, you know, when you write jokes, you're using your quick twitch muscles. It's speed, and you work up an energy, and it's all kind of free association. And with a novel, with fiction, everything slows down, and you try to get in a state of mind where you are inhabiting the lives of people that you create, and the process is slow, and sometimes agonizing. But what did you mentioned Philip Roth? What does he say? The ordeal is the ordeal is part of it, part of the process, or the ordeal is part of the is part of the journey. And it, you know, when I tell people, when you know, there's novelists, there's guys that write 8 hours a day, novelists, and I can never go more in a session. I can never go more than maybe 3 hours is the most that I can do. Probably between two and three. And when you talk to other novelists and they say to me, well, how much do you get out of a session? I said, well, I said, if I'm lucky on a session, I'll probably get 400 words. And they're all, that much? And that's how slow the process is. But I really appreciate that. And it I think that my joke writing, that helps my fiction writing, and my fiction writing helps my joke writing, because I keep them so separate. You know, it's like doing cardio one day and weights another day.
Well, and two things struck me when you said that. One is that there always seems to be a wise guy in your books. Cy, I think, this time. Actually, everyone who's not Charlie Traub seems to be a bit of a wise guy in the book. Mom, Ducky. Even Allison is kind of a smartass.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's an interesting observation. You know, the two best things, the two best pieces of advice I ever heard about writing fiction is, you know, write what you know, but make your characters' lives complicated. And, you know, everybody thinks their own story is fascinating or their own life is fascinating. And, you know, it may very well be, but it ain't complicated. And that's the thing you get to do with fiction. And so I think that if you're going to have people observing, and this is the first novel I've written in the first person, so you lose the ability to say what other people are thinking because you're not the omnipotent narrator. So you can only say what the main character is thinking. You can't assume anything. So all you get from the other characters is what they're saying. You don't get their movement or anything unless you're observing it. And so, I mean, why not make them colorful? I just hope that the characters are distinct. I hope that, you know, my goal is that, you know, we don't want to give, you know, we don't want every line to be able to be said by everybody.
Well, you seem to have found an interesting vehicle for dealing with the fact that the first person, in that you periodically will tell us something, and then you'll say, well, that's not entirely true, or that's not, I've jumped ahead 2 months here, and then you'll go back and tell us, and then you do have sort of the benefit of what those other characters did or were thinking, because you're building back. So
right, because well, that's okay. That's you got me. That my background as a journalist, because I was a sports writer before I became a comic, and my first book, The Ringer, my agent Jennifer Walsh at the time said to me, because I started to. She asked me a question. This is the first time I met her, and she had just read my book. And she asked me a question. I started to answer it, and I said, okay, well, hang on. Let me just go back 5 years. And she said, you talk just like you write. You go back, and then you come up to the present day. And she said, you do that in too many chapters in this book, and you have to you need to go chronologically more. And it was a tremendous note and a tremendous piece of advice, because that way when you do that, when you go back and then come up to the present, it really it stands out. When I started, I wrote about 20 pages of this book, maybe 30 pages in the third person, and then I thought, you know what would be great, because the book was about a guy trying to live a non-psychological life, trying to live an unexamined life. A guy who leaves therapy tries to live an unexamined life. And I thought that it would be a great sort of inside joke with myself if I wrote this book in the first person, because this guy that is just trying to live in the moment is so self-involved that everything is – I just thought that that was so self-absorbed. I thought that that would – it was just a little joke with myself that I hope that the reader would pick up on. So now you start to write the book in the first person, and, you know, it's a dream for about 2,000 words. And then you realize, ooh, because we think about Catcher in the Rye, or, I mean, that's the book that, or Gatsby. These are books in the first person. And you think, oh, well, this is because they are great books. And it's like, oh, this is so easy. I. and then you realize, ooh, wait a minute, I can't say what this guy's thinking. I can't, if I'm one place, I don't know where anybody else is. And then I realize, ooh, I think I need to do a little research on this. So I read Wonder Boys by Michael Chabon.
Oh, yeah.
Because I like him a lot, we share an agent, and I hadn't read the book, and I'd seen the movie, which was really well done, and I hadn't read the book, and I'm reading this book, and, you know, I ain't him. I ain't my, you know, but I read this book, and I kept saying to myself, it was the same thing over and over when I'm reading this book. Oh, okay, I get it. Move and observe. Move and observe. That's the whole thing to me with first person, writing in the first person. You got to keep moving and you got to keep observing, because that's all you have. So that was, once I figured that out, then I added the little cheating of, well, I don't really mean that, and go back. But you read it a little too closely. Sorry.
Well, that's what I get paid to do. By the way, as a literary aside, I have to point out Michael Chabon wrote the introduction to one of my books. So,
nice credit.
Yeah, it's not bad. He did it more as a favor to the guy I was writing about, but nonetheless.
He's got some moves, man. Yeah. He's got some moves. And he's got a lot of moves. He doesn't have, like, I think I got about 3 moves, and he's got about 80. So, yeah, pretty good. Good for you.
Yeah. But one more thing you have in common. You both have interesting professional wives. Probably not a dull moment with either of your wives, I'm guessing.
Well, you know, it's funny because people ask me all the time when because they don't, you know, I'm not, my stand-up career has been appropriately forgotten. So people just, you know, my wife is a comic and I'm a writer. So everybody always says, oh, so you write for your wife. And I always say the same thing. No, this is how it works. This is how I write my wife. She says something funny, and I say to her, write that down. That's how it works. She don't need any help from me.
Got it. I want to come back to Charlie for a minute. It seems to me, anyway, that he is not you. Certainly not. I mean, you've had a successful career. You have a successful life. You seem to be fairly well adjusted. Charlie's a bit of a schmuck. Shlemiel, pick your word.
Well, I'm not going to disagree, but I am. That's interesting that you feel about him that way, because I look at him, as I look at a lot of my heroes in my books, as a guy living life on his own terms. He has a pretty nice setup for a job. He's a fairly independent. He's clearly bright. He's clearly aimless. He's clearly aimless. But there's things about him that I admire. His especially. See, here's basically what happened was, and you, because you were nice enough to read Everything Hurts. After Everything Hurts, I said, Bill, that's enough with the unorthodox shrinks. You had two in the ringer. You had one in Time Won't Let Me. And you had one beauty in Everything Hurts. So that's enough. You need to write a non-psychological novel. You need to write a book about a guy trying to live the non-psychological life. So great. Okay, this is a good idea. And then I realized quickly, well, I can't do that. And I have to have the guy leave therapy. And which I do in the opening chapter. And then I realize that the shrink he's leaving needs to be a character. So I say to myself, okay, just once more, this guy's really going to be nuts. And, you know, we're really going to go out on it. So I created, you know, a thoroughly inappropriate and this guy is really a piece of work, Travis Waldman. I'm very proud of him. Talk about making your characters' lives complicated. And that's how this grew. Basically how it grew, interestingly enough, is that my wife was in therapy for a short amount of time. She'd seen other people like I had seen other people, and she ended therapy, but she liked her therapist, and they would meet every 9 months, and they would have dinner, and I knew the guy too, and so the first time, and you know, the thing about a therapist is, ideally, you're not supposed to know anything about them. You know, that's the idea. So they would go out to dinner, but because they had finished therapy, and she would come back, and I would say, "How was dinner?" And she would say, "Well, you know, he's thinking of selling his place on Fire Island." I went, "Wait a minute, his place on Fire Island?" You know, and she would tell me these things about him that weren't intimate, but they were private, and I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated by someone who, after therapy, tries to be friends with their therapist, and not in a crazy "what about Bob" way, but I thought that was fascinating, and I thought that was sort of part of the unexamined life.
Can we point out that when you make that "what about Bob" reference, that's a reference to the Richard Dreyfuss, Bill Murray movie, not about this Bob Andelman.
And thanks for pointing that out. Well, that is I think it's a very underrated movie. It doesn't end well, but man, I think the first two thirds, and I love Richard Dreyfuss and I love Bill Murray. But man, there's a lot of moments. There's a lot of beautiful moments in that movie. So that was the deal. And it was going to be one of these things where originally it was the guy trying to be friends with his therapist. And I said, you know, that's just not interesting enough. He can try, but his therapist is going to be really, really, really nuts and really inappropriate. And here's the thing about therapy. And I've been in it, you know, a long time. Well, if you consider 4 decades a long time. But Woody Allen had the best line. "I'm going to give it 2 more years and then I'm going to Lourdes," as he said in Annie Hall. here's the thing about therapists. There are many, 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 many therapists out there, just like there are many, 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 many stockbrokers. And there are 7 stockbrokers that actually make money, and there probably are 7 really good therapists. And my hope for you is that you have one of the 7.
Right. Travis, I don't want to go too, because I don't want to give away too much, but Travis, right. I was expecting the storyline with Travis to go in a different direction than it did. I was sure that he was pretending, and, you know, that he was kind of faking his situation at one point, but then, of course, he's not. And that's really all I wanted to say, is just, I was sure when we find him in his new setting that he was faking it just long enough to, because he was up to something, but... So I was surprised.
Oh, that would have been a good way to go. That would have been a good way to go. But you know what scene? And I guess this is either a good thing or a delusional thing on my part. When I reread some things that I've written in books, I really can't believe that I wrote them. You know, I'm very tickled. And there's a scene near the end of the book where he runs into his former therapist, Travis Waldman, and he's at an outdoor cafe with someone, and that with a man, and that scene just tickles me to no end. I look at some of these lines and I said, "Wow, I'm very pleased that I came up with that." And there's a little bit of a turn. There's a couple of turns. It's a couple of turns, and the other thing about this book is the thing that people always ask novelists is how much is autobiographical. And as I say, I usually run in my books, I usually run about 60-40, you know, 60 real stuff, 40 creative. And I went definitely the other way in this one. I'm more 30-70. And I think that's the way it needs to go on your fourth novel. You know, I love Richard Price, and I love his early stuff. You know, his later stuff is great, but it's not his early stuff. And the thing I love about his early stuff is I know he's writing about himself. But as he said, you know, after 4 novels, I'd run out of stuff about me, and then I had to do some research. So
Almost. I'm sorry. The thing I thought was perhaps most you in the book, and this is there's no way for me to know this, so I'm just guessing, is the way that Charlie Traub is constantly, he's in his own head so much. He's always thinking about what is he thinking about. He's trying not to live the unexamined life, but he's constantly in his own head. And I figured maybe that's where we're seeing Bill. Maybe Bill's always thinking about what he's doing, and he's rethinking and he's questioning, and I thought maybe that's the similarity here.
Well, I think that that's interesting that you say that, and I hope I'm telling the truth here. I think that I used to be like that, and I'm not nearly as much like that now. And the reason I know I'm not as much like that now is because I wouldn't be able to write about a guy that's constantly in his own head. If I was constantly in my own head, I wouldn't be able to observe that way. I wouldn't have that insight because I'd be so delusional. One time I was talking to a guy, and he was talking to me about some situation, and you know, just on and on and on. And I said to him, you know, You really need to go help somebody or do some service because you are much too self-centered. And his response was, "I'm self-centered. Me. I'm self-centered. You're telling me I'm self." I mean, he couldn't even answer being self-centered without referring to I'm self-centered. And that's a guy that does not have an observing ego. And I think that with Charlie, I think that even though you may feel that he's a schmuck, I hope that in the book that you're kind of rooting for him, and that, you know, is he gonna get out of his own way? And I think that he kind of does. He does. I think he does in one instance. I think he does it in terms of women. I think he does it in another instance. You know, I'm working on a book now. I'm writing a sequel to The Ringer about halfway through. And, you know, I have to have a little conversation with myself, and I say, Bill, you can't have a guy be alone again at the end of the book. You have to have a guy fall in love. You must. I mean, you fell in love. Come on. And it's funny, because when the book came out, I did a wonderful event with Adriana Trajani, who I know you know, and very successful novelist, and a wonderful, really a wonderful woman. And she knows my wife. She knows Adrian. And she says to me near the end, see, I'm going to get emotional. She says to me near the end of this event, she says, you know what? She said, I don't want to tell you how to sell books. She said, but you have such a great marriage. Why women would give anything to read about your love with Adrian, would give. And, you know, I got, well, I'm like, I'm getting now. I said, you know, that's just too private. What I know about love, I just don't think I can pass on, because it's, you know, I just have I feel like I have a very unique situation that that I was sort of lucky enough to stumble into, and I don't think I can write about it. I don't know how we got off this, but there's a scene at the end of the book, where another favorite scene of mine, where Charlie, he finally goes on a blind date. He finally goes on a blind date. And I didn't know how this was going to go, but I started writing it, and I said, I see how this is going to go. And I wanted to make, and the woman, you know, I know he's a fictional character, and I know she's a fictional character, but gee, I really wish they'd gotten together. I really, because it was right, but he was not ready. So, but it was funny. It was funny. There's a good line near the end where she gets up to leave because she says she has to go to the ladies' room.
Yeah.
And he says, what I didn't know was she meant the ladies' room at her house.
That was a very good line. I like that.
Thank you.
I like that a lot. One of my favorite scenes in the book is actually it's Charlie and a woman, but poor Charlie, it was his sister. He actually it's a really sweet thing in a book.
Oh, yeah.
Where they actually, you know, they find that they're not so different after living their entire lives apart, pretty much.
Right, right. And again, that's, you know, I'd like to tell you that I'm one of these really thorough guys that maps everything out. But if I'm lucky, when I end a session, if I'm lucky, I know how the next session will start in terms of what. But that's rare. I mean, usually there's a lot of staring down, and, you know, I go into my wife's office and I say to her, I said, listen, I know I've said this before, but this time it's over. This time it's really different. And she said, you say this every time. So that was one of those things where, Charlie and his sister were so estranged that I didn't even know how to get them together. I had no idea. And, you know, because, and in my mind, it's like, well, this guy is aimless. So what? So it's more aimlessness. But then it's like, you know, Bill, you have kind of an obligation to have some interpersonal contact with people, and it worked out well. And I remembered a little bit of a story of something that had happened to me, and I gave it to her, to Allison. And it was great. Yeah, it really worked out well because it was comparable to what had happened with Charlie and his marriage. By the way, the other thing about there's a big piece of this book that I wrote that originated. Bonnie Dressler was who's a character in the book. I wrote a short story a million years ago, right at the not quite the height of the Clinton impeachment nonsense, but sort of right around there. And I wrote a short story called Got a Shot about a guy who was running a news program, and he becomes infatuated with a woman who's one of the talking heads. And it's in the middle of the Clinton era, so he and she's very brazen, and she's very – so he figures that she's so bold – in how she's describing everything, that she must be very free sexually, and he must have a shot with her. And that was so. I always liked the piece. It never got published anywhere. And I said, "Well, let's. I like Bonnie Dressler. Let's bring her back." And she's a great character. And a lot of people have said to me, "Where they just assume with a novelist that everything is true." So they said, "Where can I meet Bonnie Dressler?" And I said, "She lives in my brain. Sadly, I don't have a number for her."
Bonnie, I'd like to read an entire novel about. I think she would be, it'd be really interesting to, like, go back before, let's see, I try to be careful not to give too much away, but to tell us her life up to Clinton, so we know how she became.
That's great. You know, it's funny because I talk about when people say, how do you start a novel? And I don't know about anybody else's process, but I need, what do I tell people? I said, I need 1.5 pieces to start a novel, meaning I need a character and a situation, or two characters, I need something. And I knew I had the guy. So I had 2.5 pieces. I knew I had Charlie Traub, I had the therapist, Travis Waldman, and I knew I had Bonnie Dressler, who was a half a piece. And so I knew I had 2.5 pieces to start. And, you know, the thing about when you come up with a good character, like Cy, I love the character, which is based on my old next-door neighbor. Oh, I'll tell you a great story about this. When you have a character that you're fond of, I don't know about other novels, but I always think to myself, how about just 300 pages on Bonnie Dressler, or 300 pages on, and, you know, that's a great idea, except it's not a novel. It's not a novel. It's like a manifesto. So I knew that I wanted to base a character on my Adrian's and my next door neighbor, whose name was Marvin Siegel, who was very, very much like Cy Siegel, and he's based on. And we love this guy. Now, the guy Marvin Siegel, he passed away a month before the book came out. He was 85, and he passed away. Lived in the apartment next door to us, and. We loved him. Adrian, me, and Marvin Siegel were never together. We always had, it was either Adrian and him. He always wanted me out of the way to get to Adrian, basically, was his plan. And he loved to tease me about going to Harvard, and he loved to tease me about that I was an aristocrat. You know, he was, and a lot of that stuff is in the book. Okay, so he dies. And his brother owns the apartment that he lives in. So his brother is 83, and I call his brother, and I say, I want to come to the funeral. And he said, well, it's not, it's just going to be like 6-7. I said, well, I loved your brother. He was the best neighbor. My wife loved him, and I want to come to the funeral. And he says to me, well, would you like to speak? I said, I'd like to close. I said, because I got some stories about this guy, because I had some letters. I said, I've also I have a book coming out, and your brother is a major character in the book. And he, you know, his brother just, he couldn't really take it in. So I go to the funeral. I kill at the funeral. I mean, you know, I mean, just, you know, I'm reading letters. I'm doing, and every, and it's a, it's, you know, it's a fixed fight because everybody knows this guy. Brilliant, brilliant man. So the character in the book is Sysig. So now what happens is, because it's New York City, his apartment is vacant now. It's a studio part. It's next door. So now I wait the customary 2 weeks, and then I call his brother and I say, have you thought about what you're going to do with the apartment? Because Adrian and I are interested. So he ends up selling the apartment to me, and we closed about a month ago. But here's the point. A couple of months ago, in the middle of the negotiations, I sent him Shrink Thyself. And I said, I hope you think that I did, you know, that I characterized your brother in a respectful and proud way. I send the book. Now, it's almost getting time to close in the apartment, and we see each other. And he says to me, Alan Siegel, he says, I read your book. It was a little fast for me, you know, 83-year-old Jew. It was a little fast for me. He said, it was very good. I said, what did you think about the character based on your brother? He says, what character was that? I said, Mr. Siegel. Oh, I must have missed that.
Oh, my God.
Right?
I don't know what to say to that. No,
yeah, no, that's great.
What I was thinking, though, is only the comedian going to give a eulogy at the funeral would want to close. Very important to him that he gets to close. That's, and he kills at the funeral.
I haven't been a comedian officially in a long time, but I still have that sensibility. I still have that sensibility.
He doesn't want to open. He doesn't want a middle. He wants to close. I get it.
That's right. That's right. You know, when my friend Richard Jenny passed away and they had the memorial, I mean, the jockeying among us to who's going to get to close. And that was a situation where I was much more comfortable going in the middle because I know that others had bigger and better stories. I had some good ones.
By the way, I think you undersell Bonnie. Going back a minute or two in the conversation, you were saying that you need to have a piece and a half to do a book, and you figured you had Charlie was a piece and Travis was a piece, and you figured Bonnie was like a half a piece. Yeah. I'm thinking from what I've read of Bonnie, she was at least a piece and a half. Sorry, folks. I'll be here all week.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And you really, you know what I like about that? You took your time. she's that's the great thing about fiction is that you can you can go build yourself a woman in your spare time, and all the women in my fiction are just forms of my wife because they're all women that are too smart for their own good, which is this purgatory that some women have to live in, where they're just, you know, they're too smart for their own good, and they're, you know, they're either misunderstood or ignored, and it's just too bad. It really is. It's a damn shame.
So here's something completely off track. It occurred to me that the name Charlie Traub sounds a lot like Charlie Schwab.
Well, that's funny. That's funny. I'll tell you why. He's named Charlie after Charlie Citrine in Humboldt's Gift. The Traub part. Yes. The Traub part, I can't tell you except I don't know how I came up with it. I like all my main characters have one-syllable last names. It's just no, they don't, because College Boy was Harvey Sussman, but Phil Camp right? Marty Fleck from Everything Hurts. I find it more manageable. So that's all I got on that. I never knew anybody named Trout.
Well, okay. I just thought I'd ask. I was thinking.
But no, I think that's absolutely a legit question.
Maybe you had a bad experience with Charles Schwab as an investment broker or something.
I'm still. I have one little account with them, and they don't.
How
bother.
How would I know that? I just took a
they don't bother. No, what am I giving out this information? I'm with a house about as big as that. So we'll say that. We'll leave it at that.
Well, I'm sorry. So you're not going to give us any account numbers?
No. any routing numbers.
No, yeah. Routing. Yeah, that's what I was. I just thought, yeah. I'd wait a second and see if anything comes out. All right. So let's, before we have to wrap up, I do want to ask you a little bit about your day job. Not too much.
Sure.
It's coming to an end in a couple months. And I wondered, I mean, are you.
That the percentage of this interview between my fiction and Dave, it's an all-time record. It's an all-time record because usually, you know, we flip the other way. So go ahead, ask away.
Well, you've been here before. We have talked about Dave before.
Right.
And I, you know. But I just want to, I mean, it's a couple months before the show will wrap up. Are you ready for the end, I guess is what I'm wondering.
No, first of all, they haven't set a date for the last show. So there's no, in one sense, there's no finish line because you don't know the date. In the other sense, you know, you have 6 months of shows or however many months ahead of you, and, you know, you're just trying to, I don't want to sound like the coach that says we take them one game at a time, but you really, you know, every day, and I've said this about the job, having been a newspaper man and a magazine writer, it's like working for a daily newspaper, a weekly magazine, and a monthly magazine, because you've got that day's material that you churn out. You've got the stuff that takes a little while in production, and then you've got the big prop pieces like the Halloween costumes, which we did last week. We write those at the beginning of August. It takes 3 months to put them together, just like a monthly magazine, you turn your piece in 3 months in advance. So so you're just always kind of focused on that day's show. I think if you and I were having this conversation in April, I would be much more articulate about the end of the show. I think that I think all of us, and there's so many of us that have been there such a long time. I think that on one hand, we're sad, we're very sad about it ending. But now that we know that it's ending, a lot of us wouldn't mind. A lot of us think that we'd be spared the emotional pain if the thing just ended tomorrow. Yeah. If all of a sudden, you know, gone. But that's just, you don't get that. Nobody gets out. You don't get out alive like that because you would go through it. It would come out sideways another way. So so everybody right now is behaving as if we're in the middle of another November sweeps. I think that things are really going to happen in the sort of wistful nostalgia. I think that last Darlene Love show on December 18th, I think all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute. Oh, this is really the last time. I think that's going to be, because right now I haven't felt that way at all. I haven't felt that way at all because any guest that we love, we know will, you know, with 6 months, we know they're coming back. We know that if it's like Martin Short was on the other night. Oh, my God. Martin Short. You don't want to say best, but if there's a better talk show guest, you know, buy it. I mean, he is. He said something years ago. He says stuff to Dave that is, and it's so earnest. Years ago, this is my favorite line of his. He comes out. He always comes out and he tells Dave how fantastic he looks. And he's, I was watching on the monitor. Is Justin Bieber guest hosting the show today? And it's so, it's said, you know, with great earnestness, but it couldn't be more fatuous. Well, this is years ago. Matt Roberts, the head writer, and I always talk about this. And he's said a couple of lines, and then he says to Dave, can I just say something? I admire the decision you've made to wear your suits tighter. I mean, come on. So, but you know, you just saw Martin. He was on the show this week. You know he's going to come back one more time. So I don't know if I answered that question at all.
Probably not. That's okay. Yeah. I probably didn't even get anywhere close to an answer. So let me try another question. So for people who all they know about you is this line, well, he's been a writer with Letterman since 91. Can you just give people a sense of like what when the show is in production, what your day is like? What do you have to produce start today to the end of the day?
Well, my concentration has always been on the monologue. I write on other aspects of the show, but since I've been hired, my concentration was, you know, on the opening few minutes of the show. And when I was hired at NBC in 91, a monologue was three jokes long, sometimes two, because the whole thing at NBC was, whatever you do, don't be the Tonight Show. So it wasn't even called the monologue. It was called, they were called the opening remarks. And to this day, at the top of the blank page every day, I still write opening remarks. I still write that every day, because that's what I wrote when I came in. So I get in. The monologue is run by myself and Steve Young, who is the only writer that's been at the show longer than me. He came right out of Harvard. He started in 1990, and I started in 91. So Steve Young, let me tell you, is the best, most versatile writer they've ever had on the show. He can do anything. His sensibility has never gone out of style with the show. Here's the thing, if you're the writer on a show on time, you know, you don't know anything, then you start getting stuff on, and then you become like a star, and then you get older and the other writers get younger, so you don't get as much stuff on, and then you just have to, you know, and I'm the old guy. You know, Steve Young has been there a year longer than me, but he's also about 12 years younger than I am.
Wow.
So, I get in, I start working on my jokes, I get the other raw material coming in to see what else might be helpful. In terms of the monologue. Now, meanwhile, the other writers have assembled in the conference room, and they are now pitching ideas to the head writer, Matt Roberts, for videos, interrupts, live pieces to put, because we now interrupt the monologue with these short, they're interrupts, they're either live interrupts, video interrupts, ads, which are pictures. So rather than the show used to be much more, fragmented, there was the monologue, and then there were the video pieces, and then there was the, but it's all been, it's all combined. We've been doing that for a few years. So they start pitching ideas to Matt based on things in the news, and Matt, the ones that he likes, or the ones that they can develop, then they then script up. So that's done. That's done. The meeting with the writer, the pitch meeting's at 9, then they all go away at 10, and then from 10 to 11, they're scripting up those pieces. And then from 11 on, those pieces go into production. The video pieces, and you got to hire voiceover guys, you got to get new, and each writer produces his own extra, or we call them extras, you know. They edit it, they pick the music, they get the voiceover people. So each writer is in charge of whatever's going on. So now And meanwhile, Steve and I are working on the monologue, and Chris Belair is another monologue writer, and Mulholland and Barry out in L.A., who have written for Dave for years, used to write for, wrote for Johnny for 20 years. So now all of that is coming together, and then they will at 2:30 hang on, I want to get this right. At 2 o'clock, the producers and the head writer, they go down to rehearsal, and they rehearse the extras, the tape pieces, the live pieces, the interrupts. And meanwhile, at 2:45, I go down. All, you know, Dave has selected jokes, you know, has read the monologue, the pages. He selected those jokes. Those jokes go on cue cards. Steve and I will put some of our own jokes on cue cards to fill it out, to get enough topics. And now we go down, and at 2:45, I go down and I work the monologue with Dave. We go through it a couple times. We edit it. We take out jokes. We rewrite them. You know, he's still, when all is said and done, he's still the best writer on the staff. He's the best rewriter on the staff. And so that's a process. And then we all, myself, Matt Roberts, the head writer, and three executive producers, we sit down and we review the extras and the interrupts to put in the monologue. We put the show together basically in that last hour and a half before the taping at 4:30. And that's and I forgot about the top 10. The top 10, there's a top 10 topic meeting at 12:30. They pick the topic, and those passes are due in at 1:30. And if we're light, the head writer says, let's make another pass of these. So every writer is turning in his own or her own top 10 list. So that's going on separately. And then there's stuff that's being worked on for future shows. And I'm not even talking about talent and what the segment producers do to produce the segments with the, you know, and every once in a while, you know, Bruce Willis is on, he wants to do something wacky, or there's just a million things, and it goes the pace. It's a furious pace, and then here we go, showtime, 4:30 to 5:30, and then the taping is over about 5:30, quarter of six, and then you go up to your office, and you have a bite of dinner, and you go, okay, now tomorrow, and then you start. Right. So I hope I did a good job of crystallizing the day for you.
I don't even remember what the question was. So let me ask another one. So who took credit? Which of the writers years ago? Which of the writers took credit for writing the bit where Drew Barrymore jumped on the desk and danced and flashed Dave? Somebody must have taken credit for that, right?
That was all Drew, all the time.
Just kidding. You've had the interesting experience of not just writing for the show all these years. You've actually been a guest on the show, and I wondered if that changed your perspective at all. I mean, you don't write the guest segments, that kind of thing, but does it change your perspective of what it's like to actually be out on the stage?
Absolutely, 1,000%. Because, and I remember when we did two Shakedown shows before we went on the air at CBS, and I was still doing stand up. And Dave says to me, "I want you to perform stand up on one of the Shakedown shows." And I thought, well, you know, I'd never gotten on the show for real. This was as close as I was going to get. I said, "Oh, that'd be great." So because they really wanted to test everything, I came out and I did stand-up. And then it's like, you know, come on over. I did panel, which they never did, but they wanted to see – they wanted to test everything. They wanted to see what that looked like. So I had never been in the chair facing him. And I think my segment with him, the panel, was like 5 minutes or whatever it was. 5 minutes or an hour or a set or 5 seconds. And I remember, and now I had known the guy now for 2 or 3 years. I'd worked with him, no, 2 years, 2 or 3 years. I'd worked with him every day. And I remember sitting there while he was talking to me and thinking, I can't believe how comfortable he is. I'm a wreck. He's so comfortable. He's so at home. Now, that's 1993. I'm sorry, I've been with the show 2 years. That's 1993. So you would think, well, that's got to change. I'm a kid. I've been with the show 2 years. I did stand-up. So now I start getting on when my books come out. And if anything, that feeling about how comfortable he is, how much I know about him, to sit across from him, and yet he is so, it's even more intense that I cannot, I'm astounded with how comfortable he is and how uncomfortable I am, how at home he is. And it, to me, that speaks to why he's so good. You know, when he was out with Shingles in 2003, we had a lot of guest hosts, and one of them was Nathan Lane, who's a good friend of mine and who is as talented and as quick on his feet as anybody. And I stand on stage every night, and I stand under the spiral staircase just to the left of home base, to the left of the desk. And I remember that night because Nathan, very cool, very glib, the whole night, every break when he would, I'm going to do him. So I'm going to turn my chair. So you're me, and I'm Nathan Lane. Can we see me okay? Yep. And I'm Nathan Lane, and I'm looking at the audience, and this is what I got after every segment. Okay, hey, stick around. We'll be right back. And the band's playing, and the camera goes off, and he would do this. To me, he couldn't believe how tough it was. He couldn't believe how tough it was, and he couldn't believe how little time had gone by since the last time. He couldn't believe how difficult it was. He kept doing that. And Barbara Gaines, my best friend, who was the executive producer, is the executive producer and was the floor producer for years behind the podium. She's great friends with him as well. And we would scream every time he would do that because we knew how difficult it was. You know, and everybody, and I've said this before, especially if you're a comic, every comic thinks, I could do that. I go out, I do a monologue, I got plenty of time. I do the monologue, well, you ask a few questions. And you know what? Every comic is right. They could do it for a night or two nights. But 33 years, and let me tell you something, maybe this does not speak well of me and my mental capacities, but I have seen him talk to actors and actresses and rave about movies very specifically, very thoughtfully, with great insight, rave about them. And I will go up to him after the segment and say, so you like that movie? And he would go, you know, and that doesn't mean he's a great act. That just means that he's a really good communicator and a really good broadcaster. And it's a performance. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. It's funny that you said that because I know in doing what I do, which I'm not comparing in the slightest, but I do try to read the books and I do try to watch the movies or the TV shows of people who are going to be on the show. And
right.
If it's a complete disaster, I respectfully back off because I couldn't get away with suggesting that I liked want you to go see it.
Right. I'm not giving away any secrets because Dave himself said this in an interview. He said he gave away one of his tells. He said, you know how you can tell if I don't like a movie? If I ask the actor or the actress, where'd you film this? And we talk about the location.
Yeah.
And we talk about the town and the people. He said, that's a little inside base. So I'm not giving away anything. Yeah. The man himself said this.
I've been there. I'll try to talk about anything but the book or but the movie.
Right.
Let's go back to the comedian in you. I know you're going to have the answer to this question. Give me a couple of lines that you've written for Dave over the years that you were particularly proud of or that he really liked, and then give me one that you just couldn't get past him and get on the show that you still think would have killed.
Yes. Okay. My two favorites, Frank Sinatra came out with years ago. He came out with a line of signature neckwear. And the joke was, "Oh, I hope I'm not I hope I'm not too late with a name for this: alleged mob ties." Dave loved the joke. He said to me, "God wrote this joke." That was years and years ago. Here's a joke from a couple of years, from maybe a year, maybe a little more. No, about a year ago. And I talked him into this joke, and I was very prepared. You can't, every once in a while, I'll say about a Mulholland and Barry joke, "I think you missed one here, or what about this one?" And he'll reconsider it. I would say I bat about 300 on those if I give them to, and they're not, they're very rarely my joke. They're usually other guys' jokes. But there was a joke that I wrote that I love, and I said, "You know," I said, I don't do this too much, but you really need to reconsider this." And he did it. And it was when Pope Francis said that he would not judge gay priests. And the joke was, I believe his exact words were, "Let he who is without sin cast the first musical." And that was as good as I can do. I talked him into one a few years back when Pat Buchanan was running for president and he was in Arizona, and I said, the joke was, "Hey, you know, Pat Buchanan in Arizona, you know, the great thing in Arizona, it's a dry hate." That was one I was very proud of. And there was one that I thought of the other night, when the impeachment proceedings began against Clinton. And Dave, to his credit, does not like to end jokes in quotes, which a lot of comics do all the time, because his point is, what am I, an impressionist? What am I? I'm saying what the guy is. He very rarely likes to do that. So this was an exception where they opened the impeachment proceedings and in the Senate. And Strom Thurmond said, "Hey, wake me up when you boys decide to vote on slavery." And that, I give him a lot of credit for that. And
that's the line that made me ask you the question, because I saw that on your blog, and I thought, okay, yeah, if he remembers that, I got to ask him if he has some other good ones. Yeah.
Right, but I don't, but, you know, but there's very few that I remember, you know, because you got to write them the next day, so they kind of go into the air. But is there, boy, that's interesting. Is there one that, you know what, the second this is over, I'm going to think of the one that he hasn't done that, I'm going to think of the one that, oh, you know what, if there's probably a couple on Twitter that he didn't take that I was really, that I was particularly proud of. But I understood why, you know, he always has his reasons and he always says his reasons.
Well, the good news is I've only got one more question. What? I'm sorry? All right, so one more question, Bill. What are you going to do next? I mean, you know, you've got, you know, 5-6 months left, maybe, of Letterman shows. This book is out. Are you going to pursue another TV writing gig? You want to just stick to writing books? What are you thinking?
Well, I'm not, because, like I said, however many 100 shows that we have left, first of all, I don't relish that I'll be a 58-year-old Jew gag writer out in the street. That's not exactly in demand. I think about what my friend John Max, who wrote for The Tonight Show for years, Leno Tonight Show for years, and he writes on everything, and he's an in-demand guy. And we wrote on something together recently, and he said to me, "You know, when the Tonight Show ended with Leno, I said to myself, you know, that's the last time that I'm gonna work on what did he call it? That's the last time I'm gonna work on a mothership." So I don't know. I really haven't thought about it. I'm going to keep writing books. Like I said, I'm halfway through a sequel to The Ringer, and it'll be interesting. But I think that television writers are not meant to have jobs for 23 years. It's not. It's like musicians. You know, it's I'll see. But I don't. You know, if I had an answer, I would give it to you, but I don't know. I know there's a couple of guys, a couple of friends I've made over the years that probably would like to, you know, maybe do a little work with me, or we'll see.
Well, give us an excuse to have you back again. That's all right.
Well, that would be lovely.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can find Bill Scheff's latest novel, Shrink Thyself, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price, MrMedia.com. You've seen the show before. You know how this works. If you're watching us on MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com, you know that either to the left or to the right is a cover of the book. You click on it right now. Amazon can get it to you via drone in about 30 minutes or less. Or if you're not in such a big hurry, you can download it or you can have it shipped to you in a day or two. Just click on it. Give you a good price. Order it right now. You can also get Everything Hurts, The Ringer, his collection from the show, whatever. Order it all. Website is BillSchecht.com. And are you on Twitter, Facebook?
Twitter, at Bill Schepp. I'm not on Facebook because, you know, people really don't need to know that I had a Pop-Tart this morning.
what flavor was it?
Not that you can't say that on Twitter as well. But
well, listen, we've installed cameras in your apartment. We know what you had for breakfast. We know how long you sat on the toilet when you got up this morning. Never mind.
Nobody could do that.
Hey, Bill. Bill Schepp.
If you guessed, you'd be a half hour off.
Okay. Bill Schepp, thank you so much for coming back and joining us again on Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. This was great. I really appreciate it. And always, thanks for the opportunity to talk about my writing. Thank you.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
What you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
The Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network, and catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights. This is Adam and Acid to the Extreme.
So, I'm sorry, did you ever see the film Rubber?
I've seen Flubber.
I've heard of Rubber. Isn't that about like a tire or something? Like,
it is. Dude, Adam, you got to watch this movie. I'm serious.
Rubber?
It's so great. It's about a serial killer that is a tire. You know, kind of like Christine was a car. It's a tire.
And how much LSD was the director on when he...
I don't know. But it's great because what happens without giving anything away, the tire just kind of rolls into place, very sinister, and there's the person in the background. This was a highly entertaining movie, and the greatest thing, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but there's a scene where the local sheriff has got all his deputies together. He's describing this tire, and one of the deputies goes, "Is he black?"
Right here on the Realm Network.